I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hope you're enjoying another excellent and, let's face it, cerebral Blizzard show. I'm Pete Donaldson from The Ramble. Now, just a note to say that if you are listening to this show on Sunday the 6th of October, we are playing Brighton, the Theatre Royal, tonight. So come down, ramblelive.com for tickets. Come and see us, Brighton. We'll have a right giggle.
Die Stefan O, die geeft Puskas een vrij veld. Dat wordt een doelpunt. Ja, goal!
Good evening. Was it then the most dangerous week in the whole history of mankind? I suppose it was. We'll be through it.
Mooi schot. Goal! Puskas!
The dramatic Moscow broadcast of Mr. Khrushchev's order to dismantle Russian missile bases in Cuba took Washington completely by surprise.
Heeft het geluid duidelijk te kennen waar de spelers moeten staan. Tegen de paal!
Hello everybody, welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Opposite me, of course, is Jonathan Wilson. And on today's show, we have David Bolkova, author and commentator. David has written a number of books, including The 90-Minute Manager, Lessons from the Sharp End of Management, and most recently, The Greatest Comeback, From Genocide to Football Glory, The Story of Baylor Gutman. David, pleasure to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
David, for this episode of Greatest Games, you have gone for the 1962 European Cup final between the then holders Benfica and Real Madrid. Why have you gone for this game?
Well, put simply, this was the pinnacle of Bella Gutman's career, 1962. He'd won the European Cup the year before as coach of Benfica, and he retained it in 62, beating Real Madrid. Real Madrid had won it for the first 5 years. The European Cup competition was first competed for in 1955-6. Real Madrid won it for the first 5 years. Benfica won it following year. Bella Gutman wrested it from Real Madrid, but they beat Barcelona in the final, the first one. The following year, 1962, Benfica played Real Madrid. So this was like a fight for the crown of Europe.
It certainly was. And the name Baylor Gutman has come up there a few times already. It will continue to do so. One of the great characters of the game of football, Jonathan.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, as my latest book, The Names I Don't Go, sort of claims, the Budapest of the 1920s, the football that was played there, was incredibly influential. And of that, of the great diaspora from Hungary at the time, caused by the political and economic turmoil, Gutman is, by some margin, the most successful of the many coaches. You can make a case that Martin Bukovi, might have been the more tactically innovative, but Gutman is the one who wins the two European Cups, who has success everywhere. And he's an incredibly flamboyant, incredibly charismatic character. He
divisive is a word you'd say?
Yeah, divisive. He never stayed anywhere very long. Mm-hmm. He kept on falling out with people. The story of how he survived the war, which David's book goes into great detail on, is incredibly moving. And you know, you sort of think a man that famous, the fact he couldn't get out. You know, he went through all of that. That even sort of celebrities went through that. But yeah, I guess Gutman, he starts out as being a great centre-half. Always liked money, I think it's fair to say. Mm-hmm. So his parents ran a dance school. Mm-hmm. He himself, when there was after the First World War in Budapest, there was a sort of anti-Jewish movement. A lot of Jews were killed. He sort of fled to Vojvodina Serbia, set up a dance school there, played a bit of football, came back to Budapest when that persecution had died down. But as soon as the Austrian League goes professional in 1923, he gets out and goes to Hachoach. Is that how you say it?
Hachoach.
Yeah. I struggle with that at the end.
I think we all do.
Which is sort of this sort of militantly pro-Zionist side in Vienna. And he plays for them, wins the league with them in 1925, while falling out with them at the same time, being pretty frustrated with them. Mm-hmm. And then from there, he goes on a tour to the US. I feel like I'm telling a story. He goes on a tour to the US. Why don't you pick it up from there?
Yeah, he played for this team, Hachoach Vienna. That was an incredible story. I think in many ways, his time at Hachoach Vienna shaped his personality, because this was a team. It was just us against the world. No one likes us, we don't care, in the Millwall phrase. The anti-Semitism in Central Europe was obviously huge. We're talking 13 years. When Hachoach won the league, that was 1925. 13 years later, they have the Anschluss when the Nazis marched into Austria with the population lining the streets cheering as they entered, where Jews were made to go on their bended knees and scrub the pavements, again, to cheering crowds, where in November 1938, and during the Kristallnacht of November 9th, November the 10th, 1938, a night which really heralded the beginning of the Holocaust, 92 of the 93 synagogues in Vienna were destroyed. All the books brought from those synagogues and burnt in these medieval bonfires. Again, to cheering crowds. Just 13 years before, this, as Jonathan says, very proudly, Jewish Zionist football team had won the Austrian League amidst this great hostility. And Bela Gutman, I think...
It's worth saying they win the league in the most implausible circumstances, with their goalkeeper getting injured, playing up front and scoring the winning goal.
Well, that's right. I mean, forget Sergio Aguero in the last minute in 2012. This is the most dramatic league win of all time. The goalkeeper was injured. There's no substitutes. He puts on a sling, goes up front, scores the winning goal. Amazing. Yeah. So this us against the world mentality, I think, really during Gutman's formative years, really shaped his character. He went from Hachoach Vienna and he went to United States of America, where he played during the golden era for American football between 1926 and 1932. And he also made a huge amount of money in the United States running illicit nightclubs, bars. But after the Wall Street crash, he lost all his money. One of the many ups and downs in Gutman's life.
Yeah. And it's so important to talk about Gutman in the context of this, as you already said. But as well, survives the Holocaust, obviously, unlike his father and his sister, who are killed in Auschwitz.
I think it's worth saying as well that he comes back from the US.
Yeah.
And he tries to maintain a playing career, realises that his legs have gone, begins coaching, and he has the chance to leave. He has a visa to go to the US.
Well, that was going to be a question. As you say, in the Holocaust and all that horrible history, but why didn't he leave, do you think, David? You know, he sticks around Europe in that time and amazingly survives the Holocaust.
That's right. Well, you've got to imagine the situation in 1938 when Austria is invaded. Jews all over Europe were desperate, desperate to get out and to protect their children, to get out of Europe. And there were queues going round the corner from the consulates, from Western consulates, trying to get visas. But the Western countries, America, Britain, refused to let them in. The British, who controlled Palestine, would not let the Jews into what they perceived to be their homeland. So they were stranded there. Bela Gutman, however, I think because he spoke good English after his 6 years in the 1920s and early 1930s, got one precious visa of only 800 or so awarded to Hungarian nationals in 1938. And he goes to New York and he tries to set up a football team there or a new football league. Football had died since the great era a few years before. And he tried desperately to get the whole thing moving again. The depression had really set in the United States, recession. There was no interest in football.
Well, I think it's sort of worth slightly expanding on that, that a lot of the fans of the early teams of the late 20s had been from textile factories, and those are the jobs that are really badly hit by the depression. So exactly. Fans literally cannot afford to buy the tickets. So all the entrepreneurs who've been setting up these teams and arranging tours, and there's tours all over the place. Which we mentioned when we were talking about the Tel Aviv Derby, we talked about these great tours. They stop because the money dries up. So there's very good economic reasons for football to suddenly wither post the crash.
That's right. So he's in New York. Football's not taking off. He gets wind of an offer from Újpest to be their coach. Újpest are a major Hungarian club. He has a choice. You could say, obviously, Hungary by that stage had not been invaded by Nazi Germany, but they were an ally of Nazi Germany, and they'd already passed, the independent government of Hungary had already passed its first anti-Jewish law. So the writing was on the wall. He had the choice of security in the United States or excitement and football, which he loved, and to establish himself as a great coach in Europe. And he chose the latter option. I put it in my book. I stand by it. He risked his life for the love of football. We often hear this expression. Oh, he put his head on the line for his team.
Yeah.
He literally did it because of his love of football.
I mean, it's almost sort of Achilles Greek mythology stuff. Obviously, for him, it worked out a bit better. But it's utterly remarkable. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's very difficult to... for instance, I read a lot of Freud's letters when he leaves Vienna in, I think, in 38, certainly very late in the 30s. And he's a successful psychoanalyst. He's got his practice and he can see what's coming, but he doesn't quite believe it until, just in time in his case. And he's clearly kind of weighing up, do I give up my profession? Or, we've seen persecutions before. Is this actually worse? Well, it turns out it was much worse. And so that decision was a huge wrench. I think it's quite easy from our perspective not to really understand or not to really know. People had no notion of how bad it was going to be. And you see that, I think, certainly in Hungary, that although their government had allied to Germany, I think it was quite easy for people who didn't want to see the writing on the wall to think, well, the choice was Germany or the Soviet Union.
Mm.
Actually, that's not a choice at all if you know what the Soviets or Russians have done in Hungary in the past. So I think it was almost it was quite easy to kid yourself that they don't really mean it. And you see, even as late as sort of 43, Erbstein, the great coach of Torino, his family and his two daughters are still alive, and I've spoken to them. And they were saying, actually, although there was all these restrictions and although there was sort of this sense of fear, their life in Budapest wasn't that bad. And there was a sense that it won't happen here. And even though you had people who were escaping camps or you had stories of camps coming over the border and saying, this is what's going on, there was this sort of almost a block that people could not believe just how bad it would be. So, I don't know, you've studied Gutman more than me, but I wonder if that sort of, if he couldn't quite acknowledge, couldn't quite accept just how enormous this thing was.
It's really a general question, a philosophical question, rather than based on any knowledge, and we're all guessing. But I think it's very different to be in a situation where you don't see the writing on the wall, but on the other hand, how much is that influenced by the fact you've got no alternative?
Sure. Yeah.
A Gutman had an alternative.
Yeah.
People always, when they're trapped somewhere or they're locked into a situation, always try to persuade themselves, oh, that's the only work, there's anything I can do. And they try to make the best of it. It's a natural human impulse to try and make the best of what you've got. Gutman had the chance, this very rare chance to leave. And I think most Hungarian Jews, even though they maybe not anticipate the Holocaust, although I'm sure news of the Holocaust had reached them by 1943. In fact, many Jews from foreign countries, not Hungarian nationals, but were residing in Hungary, several thousand, I think up to 20,000, were sent over by the Hungarian government in 1941 and were all shot by the Nazis and the Ukrainian helpers. And the Hungarian Jews will have known all about that, and they will have known...
Well, and there was, although the deportations don't begin until May 44, after the German invasion, which is, what, the end of March 44?
March 19th.
The Germany invade, and basically invade Hungary because Hungary have seen what the way the war's going and they're trying to negotiate a separate peace. So even though the deportations to Auschwitz don't begin until then, and sort of, you know, the horror of the Hungarian Holocaust is, it's so efficient by then that for between, I can't remember the date, but beginning of May and July the 9th,
yeah,
there's one Hungarian Jew killed every 11 seconds. It's about 800,000, I think, in total.
During that period, it was 437,000. Yeah, it was about 8,000 a day transported to Auschwitz.
But there was still Jews had to report to work details who were being sent to these battalions, the sort of labour battalions in Ukraine, where horrific atrocities were occurring. So you're one of the great... Shibby Brown, one of the great MTK players of the 20s, dies in a work camp in Ukraine where we don't even know when he died. We have a month, but yeah, he just disappears essentially, and that was not an unusual experience.
Sure. And look, at the start of this, just to kind of bring it back, we talk about Benfica beating Real Madrid, and all that chat that you're just saying, this awful history. Bela Gutman's the main man at the centre of this match, obviously, that we're focusing on. So it is vitally important to tell where he's come from and the mindset of the man. And in the second half, we're going to talk about the game and more of his football career, of course. But it's very, very important to set the scene with Bela Gutman and just to show you or talk about the journey that he personally came through. So, quick break, and then we're back in with the football chat on Bela Gutman. See you in a moment.
Oh, you put it. Puskas. Oh, wat een mooi doorgegeven. Puskas, kans om te schieten.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
So, we've set the scene with Baylor Gutmann. The war's over, he survived the Holocaust.
Well, I mean, we should... I mean, I know the time is against us. We should briefly say how he survived the Holocaust.
Okay.
Basically, his fiancé, her brother, ran a hairdressing salon, and he hid in the attic, essentially, and would walk about on boards so that he didn't leave footprints in the dust. He was a very restless man, I think, so... It seems to have been quite difficult to keep him in the attic, that he kept on nipping out and having various scrapes.
Yeah.
And then eventually, once the deportations have stopped, he obviously decides it's...
safe to come out.
Well, I don't think it was safe to come out, but I think he made a decision that it was less dangerous to report to one of these work details than to risk being caught, because to be caught then would be certain death, whereas at least the work detail, there was a greater chance of survival. He ends up slightly oddly... working with Erbstein, who goes on to coach Torino, and they escape together.
Yeah, escape together. And Jonathan talks about it as a work detail that they're often described as labour camps. This is not a 9-to-5 job. Many people died. It was a slave labour camp, is the best way to describe it.
Mm. Okay. But they softened the ground underneath the window. They were living on the first floor of the barrack.
Yep.
They softened the ground underneath the window. There was, I think, five of them. There was a...
An actor, yes.
Saul, can't remember his surname. And the five of them jump out the window. And we actually don't know what happened. Gutmann probably went back to the attic above the hairdressing salon, but there's sort of a month, 6 weeks where he hid somewhere.
Yeah.
But survives, goes into football, and then through a whole series of scrapes, which I feel we have to skip over, ends up at Benfica.
He does, yeah. I mean, talking about his football career, I mean, if you think Brian Clough was a bit out there, or a more contemporary reference, Jose Mourinho, nothing on this guy. I mean, the famous expression, you know, the third year is fatal, came from Baylor Gutmann, of course. But he had quite a bit of success where he went, but I mean, there's certain stories of him, you know, wanting to sub off one of his players, when of course you didn't have substitutes, so he'd rather play with 10 men than...
Well, I mean, that's very relevant, because that's when he fell out with Puskás. So he was coaching Kispest, which is Puskás's team. Uh-huh. Puskás's father had been his predecessor. And there's a game when he feels one of the fullbacks is playing too aggressively, wants to take him off at half-time.
Yeah.
Puskás says, you know, don't be ridiculous, we're playing with 11.
Yeah.
At which he storms off and gets banned by the Hungarian FA for breach of contract. So he and Puskás fall out. And of course, Puskás is playing for Real Madrid in this game.
Yeah.
And although it should be said they had subsequently made up.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, David, Bellingham's career and in football is full of all these stories of falling out with people and these kind of erratic, kind of slight mad behaviours. But when he finds himself at Benfica, which I believe is where he stayed around the longest in terms of his career, he was always 1 year there or 2 years there, and all around the world, from Hungary, Switzerland, Brazil, you know, incredible globe-trotting career. But he comes to Benfica in the late 50s, having just won the league at Porto. Of course, they're great rivals. But he goes to Benfica. And am I right in saying he sacks 20 first-team players, something like that, immediately? Again, this is not Brian Clough, you've won all your medals through cheating and you can chuck them away. He absolutely... guts, no pun intended, you know, guts the team and promotes a load of youth players. And this is, you know, people must think, what on earth is going on? And yet he manages to halt Real Madrid's dominance of the European Cup, which is no mean feat, Jonathan.
Yeah, and the player he brought in for this final, he didn't play in 61 final, is Eusebio.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, the way he signs Eusebio is a great example of how he worked. He was in a barber shop. He met a player called Carlos Bauer who'd played for him at São Paulo in Brazil. And Bauer was on his way back from Mozambique and sort of said, oh, I've just met this player. You've got to sign him. He's brilliant. And Eusebio was already lined up to join Sporting. And Gutmann sort of nips in, signs him. And it turns out he signed the best player in Europe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's... Yeah, he had that decisiveness. He had that sort of... Those connections. He had the network. But he was clearly kind of a hugely sort of inspiring figure. And you see throughout his career, the pattern is he inspires his team for a year, 18 months, and then they begin to tire of him. Yeah. That's why I think people make the Jose Mourinho comparison. Yeah, there's a lot of differences between them.
Sure.
But that idea of a very inspirational figure who eventually becomes wearing.
But he has to be some sort of very intense bloke. But David, you know, that sacking of the 20 first team players or it was in Benfica. I mean, what's the mood of Benfica when he arrives? Obviously, he's just won the league at Porto, so he jumps ships and goes to Benfica, then makes this huge decision. What's the lie of the land there when he's at Benfica and all that's kind of going on?
Well, let's put this into context, because this is the time when Bela Gutmann was at his most supremely self-confident.
Yeah.
This is the period that five or six years, where everything he touched turned to gold.
Mm.
So he'd won the Paulista in Brazil, the regional Brazilian league with Sao Paulo. He then comes to Portugal and is hired by Porto. And he wins the league in his first season there. Only the second time in 20 years they'd won it. Then he gets offered a job by Benfica. And to put this in its, again, in its footballing context, Portugal was at that stage, I would say, a minor footballing nation. No Portuguese team had got past the first round of the European Cup in the four or five years since its inception. Portugal had never qualified for the World Cup. In fact, in the qualifying rounds for the 1958 World Cup, they were knocked out by little Northern Ireland. This is where Portugal was. Okay. So he took over at Benfica in 1959. He's also handicapped by the fact that Benfica, much like in a similar system to Athletic Bilbao or Yorkshire Cricket, for example, in the olden times, you could only sign players from Portugal or the Portuguese colonies, Angola, Mozambique, etc. So he was hamstrung by that. But he said to the chairman when he took the job at Benfica, I'm going to win the European Cup. And if I win the European Cup, you can give me 200,000 escudos as a bonus. And the chairman looked at him and thought, well, you can have 300,000 if you like. I don't care. So he was at his most self-confident. He comes in, much like Mourinho in his real pomp.
Mm.
Total self-confidence in everything he did. But that self-confidence suffused around him, where everyone, the players, if he said jump, they would jump, because he'd done it in the last couple of years. He had that aura around him where they really believed in him. This is gold for a coach. Mm. Ferguson had that, particularly in the later era stages of his career, when they won the league with United in 2013, mm, with probably a team which would finish fifth or sixth now. You know, the managerial influence is at its greatest when the manager has that self-confidence. So he got rid of all these players. I'm not working with 35 players. I'm working with a cohesive unit of players that I can have the most influence shaping their play and motivating them as individuals.
Man. So, yeah, Jonathan.
Should we begin with the game, finally? So, this is a sort of ageing Real Madrid team. So you've got Puskás, who's 35 by then. You got Di Stefano, who...
Also 35.
Yeah, also 35. So there's a lot of the remnants of the late 50s team. This is not a team quite as good as the late 50s team. But nonetheless, 18 minutes in, Di Stefano, long ball over top, Puskás runs on. Puskás, I have to say, moving quicker than I've seen him move in any other clip I've ever seen of him. Looking svelte.
Yeah.
Certainly compared to how he'd been 2 years earlier in the famous final when Real Madrid beat Eintracht Frankfurt. And he scores the goal. 5 minutes after that, 23 minutes gone, there's a sort of... Real Madrid get a free kick, maybe, I don't know, 10 yards outside the Benfica half. The ball's taken quickly. Puskás has got space to turn, whips the shot in. Costa Pereira, the Benfica keeper, is maybe slightly slow to get down. 23 minutes in.
It was a hell of a hit, though.
Oh, yeah, look, he strikes it beautifully. Yeah. It's a great strike.
Bounces awkwardly in front
of the
keeper.
I'm giving
the keeper the benefit of the doubt.
I think you've watched too many old videos. I think you've gone soft. But so halfway through the first half, Real Madrid are 2-0 up. 2 minutes after that, there's a free kick tapped to Eusebio. He sort of gets the ball caught under his feet slightly, but still gets this sort of little toe pokey shot out. Hits it quite hard. Ara Castellan, the Real Madrid keeper, can't hold it. Ball bounces loose, and it's slammed in by Jose Aguas. So it's 2-1. And you know, it's a great game. It's sort of
It is.
It's a very. I always think when you watch football from the 60s, you can pretty much have a guess at whether it's the first half of a decade or the second half of a decade, because something around 65, 66 is when the game changes. And this is just before Catenaccio comes in. This is very much the old football. And that, I guess, is what Gutman represents. Benfica equalise on 33 minutes. There's a ball chipped into the box. Eusebio, sort of surrounded by players, takes the ball down. I think he's probably looking to turn and shoot, but ends up laying it off to Domiciano Cavem, who drills it in. But nonetheless,
another great strike, though.
Yeah, I mean these are great technical players who are scoring great goals.
Yeah.
But Real Madrid hit back 6 minutes before half time. They go 3-2 up. There's sort of a flowing break, and the ball sort of it's half instead pops to Puskas, who. He's sort of, I guess, an inside right position, takes on his left foot, drills it in, completes his second hat-trick in a European Cup final at the age of 35, which is ridiculous. And even then, before half-time, there's a chance for Real Madrid to score again. The Paco Gento, the great winger, who had the beating of Mario Joao all game, gets by him on the outside, crosses for Luis Del Sol. His header goes over Costa Pereira, but hits the bar. So it's 3-2 at half time. And yet, what does Gutman do at half time? He walks into the dressing room and goes, "Right, we got this wrapped up, lads." I think that says everything. You know, what you're saying about the how he sort of spreads self confidence.
Yeah, totally. And he'd actually said to them after the semi final when they beat Tottenham Hotspur, "We're going to win. We're going to win. Even if they go 2-0 up, we're going to win. If they go 2-0 up, don't worry. We're still going to win the game." And at half time, he makes a bit of a tactical switch. Moving Cavem to mark Di Stefano at half time. But his main contribution at half time was this rousing, legendary team talk, which I interviewed two members of this team, Jose Augusto and Antonio Samoas, and they still talk about it in the most reverential terms, using this biblical language. Apparently, he goes round every player. He says, "Sit down, sit down, sit down. Puskas, old. Di Stefano, old. Di Stefano, tired. Puskas, tired. Real Madrid, dead. You will win." And Jose Augusto says he felt that the spirit of God was in his soul. They didn't contemplate, he claims, didn't contemplate any other result apart from victory after Gutman's speech.
That's incredible, isn't it? And so it proved to be.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of Puskas being tired is borne out in the second half, because it's him who's caught in possession. Only 5 minutes into the half, he's caught in possession in the centre circle by Angelo Martins, who drives forward, and he comes to Mario Colunga, who'd been the great star of the side before Eusebio comes along, and he ends up playing a slightly deeper role, to which he's probably better suited. And another brilliant goal, to make it 3-3.
I mean, I know you've got 8 goals to choose from, but there are some real belters in this game.
Yeah, I think that's probably the goal of the game.
I would agree with you.
And I guess the combination of that half-time team talk plus the equaliser so soon, and I guess Puskas being made to look a bit old and slow, it's sort of everything sort of is wrapped up together. 64 minutes in, Eusebio has surged down the right. And again, I think you see how tired Real Madrid are at this point. That Pachin, the left half, it's a really tired tackle, a really lazy tackle.
You didn't need VAR.
Brings Eusebio
that one.
down. A pretty blatant penalty, which of course Eusebio scores.
Yeah.
And then 5 minutes after that, you have this great surge from Benfica. They win a free kick. Eusebio takes it low, goes under Eric Casayan, and it's 5-3. And the game is done, and Benfica have retained their European Cup.
Yeah, pitch invasions and all that kind of stuff.
And you had the great symbolic exchange between young and old, a replacement, if you like, at the end of the game, when Eusebio changes shirts with Di Stefano. the great young player replacing the great old player. Gutmann lifted up above, lifted by his players, escorted off the pitch.
And back-to-back European Cups for Benfica. They've never won a European trophy or a European Cup before that, and have not won a European Cup or European trophy since, of course.
But before we go into that... just to give my book a little bit more of a plug, it's worth pointing out the Barcelona team they'd beaten in the final the previous year.
In 61.
Yeah, in 61, who had themselves beaten Real Madrid, had three expat Hungarians. So they had Kubala, they had Szybo, and they had Kocsis. This Real Madrid side, you've got Puskás, but also the team's been put together by a guy called Emil Oesterreicher, who was a sporting director. He'd left 3 months early to go to Torino, a decision he always regretted. But Oesterreicher himself had, I mean, he'd escaped a labour camp in Ukraine. I have to say the evidence is patchy, but it appears he had. And then on New Year's Day 1945, he'd been hiding out in the synagogue, well, the synagogue in Budapest, if you go there now. He'd been hiding out there and had been raided by the fascists. And he jumped out through a window and run down the street to get away, is the story that's told. In his underpants. I couldn't corroborate that, but that is certainly the story that's told. So that influence of that Hungarian generation we were talking about is very, very strong here. But anyway, Benfica, they're set up to dominate Europe for the rest of time.
Yeah.
Until...
Yeah. Well, of course, just before... So he thinks to himself, right, well, you owe me 300,000, whatever it was, and goes to the chairman or the owner of the club and is denied this money.
That's right. He wanted more money. He'd been asking for more money for several weeks. He'd already told the European media that he was going to leave, but obviously if they'd have offered him what he wanted, he probably would have stayed with such a success.
I mean, Gutmann offering to threaten to leave was a pretty constant...
Yeah,
exactly. So if they'd have offered...
Even as a player, he was always threatening to leave. I mean, if you go back to him in Austria at Hakoach, he was always mouthing off to Hungarian press of, oh, they don't listen to me anymore, they've changed their style of play. Mm. Yeah, him threatening to leave was not unusual. Yeah. However...
That's right. So he had this offer in his back pocket from Peñarol, who were the world club champions.
In Uruguay.
From Uruguay. So he decided to leave. And then if you look up Gutmann on the internet, certainly until my book came out, I think definitely the most common thing you'd read about him was this curse that he in 1962 was alleged to have said to the board when they wouldn't give him any more money. He says, okay, you won't give me any more money. I'm leaving. But not only am I leaving, but you, Benfica, will not win another European trophy for 100 years. And since that time, they've been in 8 finals, European finals, and have lost every single one. But just to qualify that, I researched this and researched this, and Benfica research department helped me with it, and they couldn't find any evidence that he actually said that. The nearest he came was in 1966 when he said, nobody will take away from me the 2 European titles that I helped to win and nobody else has won and never will win. That's the closest he came to that.
So what?
It's still, I mean, while the origin myth is pretty murky,
yep,
this is believed to the extent that in 1990, when Benfica get to the European Cup final and play Milan in Vienna, Eusebio goes and prays at Gutmann's grave to ask sort of forgiveness. Please let us win this one.
Well, I was going to say, so now that seems quite a futile thing to do.
Totally. He prayed, he knelt down before Gutmann's grave. He begged, but Gutmann wouldn't listen.
Yeah, clearly.
And Milan won 1-0. It has become a psychological issue for Benfica and for the club.
Yeah,
they've lost a couple of penalty shootouts.
Well, they lost to Chelsea in 2013, the Europa League final. I mean, they battered Chelsea and then Ivanovic got a header from a corner late on.
Should have won that game.
Yeah. And Seville beat them on the penalties. And PSV Eindhoven, I think, in 88, was it European Cup final? So, so this curse has generated... I mean, it's so much mythology about Gutmann. I mean, that statement you made before, that Gutmann, again, is so well known for, the third year is fatal.
Yeah.
Well... He might have said that early on in his career. He wouldn't have said it late on in career because he only did 1/3 season and he won the European Cup. So the third season was not fatal for Bella Gutmann.
Sure.
Fatal for Benfica, as it turned out. But
in the end.
David, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you about all this. Great to focus on Bella Gutmann. So, I mean, a life less ordinary, of course. But a phenomenal influence on football and all the rest of it, and far more beyond that. But yes, thank you, David. An absolute pleasure, Jonathan. A pleasure as always. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. Of course, if you want to hear more stories like that, go to theblizzard.co.uk. And do not forget, at Football Ramble Daily, we're here Monday to Saturday, so subscribe to make sure you never miss a show. We'll see you next week.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking, like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production. We'll be right back.